Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode.
Good morning. It's the show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, why a sports economist says a plan to keep the D-backs at Chase Field is a bad financial plan.
And the downside of the internet's newest relationship advice, protect your peace.
But first, as the new Trump administration has ramped up the president's promised mass deportations in the first whirlwind weeks of his new term, protesters have taken to the streets here and across the country to voice their opposition. They are marching and shutting down freeways and chanting Si Se Puede and holding signs that read Stop Separating Families. And they're proudly waving Mexican flags, not American flags. It's a show of home country patriotism that has some critics crawling foul. Why wave the flag of another country and not the one immigrants want to call home? But it's the kind of protest that our first guest this morning calls good trouble. Gustavo Arellano is a columnist for the Los Angeles Times, and he's on the line now to tell us more. Good morning there, Gustavo. Thanks for coming back on.
Gracias for having me.
So what do you make of these protests that are playing out in Los Angeles, here in Arizona, and kind of across the country, and the way that protesters are going about protesting?
I mean, this is something that is not new. It's been going on for 30 years in the American Southwest, where you have politicians pushing anti-immigrant anything. And the reaction, and we're talking specifically right now about young people, mm-hmm. high schoolers, college students, is to go back to, you know, if people are saying you're not American, then they're going to wave the flag of their family's country. This is not the country where they were born. It's their ancestral roots. Almost all these kids are American citizens. So you're going to say, okay, you're not American. We're going to go to a cultural identity where we don't feel shame. And so we're going to wave it in your face. Now, I think they should all be waving American flags. I think that the American flag has been turned into something from the left that it shouldn't be. But I also understand why these kids are doing it.
Right.
And again, I've been seeing this for 30 years.
Right. For 30 years. Like, the history of this goes back a long way. And you do say that there is an argument here, right, for waving the flag of your home country. Those people who have done that in the past have seen real results.
That's the interesting thing, because it's almost like you lose the battle, which is, of course, all these people getting upset. Why don't you wave the American flags? You're treasonous. You're traitors. You don't deserve to be Americans. But it's those kids who are in the, how do you say, the crucible of this that end up going on to become better activists, better people here in California, the entire state. I mean, one of our U.S. senators, Alex Padilla, was doing these types of protests all the way out in MIT back in 1994 when California passed Prop 187, which was basically the grandfather of SB 1070 for you folks in Arizona. Mm-hmm. And so he's a U.S. senator. The entire state of California became blue because of these people back in 94. I've seen it with the protest against the Sensenbrenner bill in 2006, and you're going to see this right now in the years to come.
You say it's counterintuitive, right, though, and that you do think they should be waving the American flag out there. And that's really, you know, got a lot of critics saying this is not the right message. Even if you are pro-immigrant, this is not the right message. Do you think they're helping the cause they're protesting against?
And it's not just people, by the way, who might be against illegal immigration. We're talking about advocates who do believe in some sort of amnesty, Latinos themselves, politicians saying, hey, kids, wave the American flag. It's like the worst possible optics imaginable. And again, I used to be one of those people, because I've seen this play out in real time. But just seeing the historical perspective, seeing how it all plays out, if this is what it takes to get Democrats and especially, you know, pro-immigrant people to get more people to care, to shake them out of any fear that they may have, to shake them out of any stasis, then this is what needs to be done. And that's at least that's the logic that the kids have. Mm-hmm. And I can respect that. I think it should be the American flag, but I can respect what they're doing.
Right. You said you have been one of these doubters in the past. I wonder, Gustavo, watching all of this and having seen, you know, kind of ebbs and flows of this debate in the past, what you make of the broader reaction to these mass deportations, to the kind of broader anti-immigrant kind of sentiment in the country right now?
It waves and flows and ebbs and all of that. What I have found very fascinating, and I've written about this for the LA Times, is how with Latinos, especially even children of immigrants, opposition to illegal immigration is higher than it's been in a generation in Arizona, in California, all across the United States. Now, it was easy to say, oh, if you're anti-immigrant, you're anti-Latino and you're racist. But when it's Latinos feeling that way, and by the way, the levels are still, you know, a majority of Latinos still think that there should be a way toward legalization. So it's not an over like a majority, but still the numbers are through the roof. So this is one thing that the immigrant rights movement needs to wrestle with. And that's why I do understand why, you know, the optics might be more fraught than ever. But again, history does its own thing. It doesn't care what we think about what's going on right now. And history, what was it? Mark Twain, I think, said history never repeats itself, but it rhymes.
But it rhymes. I mean, so looking at that, looking at the shift within the Latino electorate itself, right? What do you make of that? Where do you think that's coming from?
Oh, I mean, that's easy, assimilation. And specifically, anti-Latino sentiment among Latinos. So my dad was an illegal immigrant, and he came in the 60s and 70s. I had a bunch of cousins who came in the 90s. So it's easy to march for in defense of illegal immigrants when they're your own kind. And Mexicans still are the supermajority of Latinos in the United States. But then the sentiment gets watered down once those immigrants are coming from El Salvador, from Central America. And they're basically non-existent when it's Venezuelans. When you don't have, even though you might speak the same language, they're not your same people, so to speak. And at this point, you have an entire generation of people saying, hey, our parents came here illegally the right way. Our parents didn't get any government subsidies. Our parents didn't do any of that. Why do these Venezuelans get all these benefits? I hear this from my own cousins. I have to tell them, like, hey, nuestros tíos, our uncles, they came here illegally. They people talk the same sort of trash that you're talking trash on now when it's Venezuelans. And they insist to me it's completely different. And I think especially, again, the pro-immigrant movement, they need to wrestle with that. And I don't think enough of them are, because look, protests are important. I think waving the flag, if that's going to motivate kids to do more in their communities, that's great. But the fact is, you have Republicans owning the House, owning the Senate, the presidency, everywhere. How are you going to? And those are the people who at the end are the ones who have the ability and the power to either make more deportations or bring some sort of amnesty. So how are you going to win their minds?
Yeah. All right. We will leave it there. Lots to wrestle with. Gustavo Arellano, columnist for the LA Times, joining us. Gustavo, thanks for coming back on. Appreciate it.
Gracias.
A bill aimed at keeping the Arizona Diamondbacks playing their home games at Chase Field cleared a state House committee last week. In testimony at the state capitol, a team official told lawmakers the D-backs have identified around $500 million worth of repairs the stadium needs, including to the AC system, roof, and plumbing. These repairs, and who should pay for them, have led to friction between the team and Maricopa County, which owns Chase Field. The measure would redirect sales tax money collected at the ballpark and income tax paid by workers there, including the players, and put it into a fund to cover those repair costs. The team would also contribute. Right now, that money goes to fund government services. Representative Jeff Wenninger, a Chandler Republican, is the bill's sponsor.
I think anybody who's been in the stadium knows the AC is not necessarily working, and there's been this tug of war, I know, between the parties of how to keep up that maintenance. So this just takes the existing tax revenue from the footprint of the stadium and reinvests it into this public asset that the public owns to make sure it's kept up.
Wenninger says the measure includes penalties in case the team decides to leave and that the state would get back any unused money in that case. He also says having the Diamondbacks play home games during the summer helps downtown businesses during what is an otherwise quiet time. Teddy Myers, founder of Pretty Decent Concepts, which has restaurants downtown, agrees.
My wife and I chose to launch our business downtown because as natives, we wanted to take part in building a dense, thriving urban core. And without Chase Field, it just couldn't be possible. So we view Chase Field as a pivotal asset for the small business community.
Team officials say this arrangement would help keep the team in Phoenix. Amy Lynn Pierce says the Diamondbacks want to continue to be a part of downtown and contribute to its economy.
Just in 2023, in the month of October, when the Diamondbacks were in the postseason, we had over 300,000 ticketed fans. 21% of those came from outside of Arizona. Meant they were staying in our hotels, patronizing our restaurants, and spending money on goods that were from here in Arizona.
But many sports economists argue teams and stadiums don't really contribute that much to an area's economy. J.C. Bradbury, an economics professor at Kennesaw State University in Georgia, says when voters are asked to weigh in on deals to use public money to pay for even a part of a new or updated stadium, they tend to say no thanks, especially the farther west you go. He points to Tempe voters rejecting a new arena for the Arizona Coyotes as an example of this. It's better, he says, for government to contribute to what he calls complementary investments instead, things like roads, sewers, and other infrastructure. I spoke earlier with Bradbury, who's also past president of the North American Association of Sports Economists, and asked what he thought about this proposed deal for the D-backs.
Right. So it's a pretty common thing these days for professional sports teams to seek funding by sort of, rather than directly raising taxes, using some financial trickery, in which what we do is try and reallocate existing tax revenue, devote it to something that benefits the sports team, for example, a stadium or building a new stadium, and then saying, oh, we didn't raise taxes. When the reality is that you're taking taxes or tax revenue that was going to other priorities, you're taking that out of the system, and then you're going to have to raise taxes elsewhere or cut services elsewhere.
Well, and this is essentially one of the arguments being made by the city of Phoenix, which would stand to lose a pretty good amount of tax revenue if this bill were to become law. What have you seen in other places? You mentioned this is a fairly common arrangement. What have you seen in other places where this kind of thing has gone into effect?
Well, economists have been studying the economic ramifications of professional sports stadiums for nearly 50 years. And time and again, they find that they're typically money losers as public investments. And that is, most of the money that's spent in and around sports stadiums is simply reallocated from other spending within the community. When the team leaves, people spend their money on other things. So there's generally no gain in tax revenue from having a team, or loss in tax revenue when you lose a team. And I'll give you an example of a recent sports district project that opened in Worcester, Massachusetts at Polar Park. It's a AAA minor league park, but the idea was that, we're going to collect revenue from this entertainment district around the park, and we're going to pay for it. And it has never paid for itself. It runs deficits every year. And this is something that commonly happens. And you want to look at the major league level, where I live in Cobb County, Georgia, where the Atlanta Braves have their team. They also have a stadium district. It's much larger than what is around Chase Field. But that stadium also ends up costing taxpayers money, about $15 million a year.
So would it be your argument that if, for example, the Diamondbacks were to leave Chase Field, that the city of Phoenix would be able to recoup, and the state and the county would be able to make roughly the same amount of money in tax revenue as they do now with the Diamondbacks there?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no question about that. And, you know, what we see is that when teams leave communities, is that there's actually no fiscal loss. In fact, sometimes there's a fiscal improvement in the budget, because teams often demand a lot of things in public resources that aren't even on the books, you know, use of police, just special treatment here and there. So this is an unambiguous research finding that sports stadiums are not revenue generators. They're actually quite bad for the fiscal bottom line. Now, in terms of, you know, how big the damage is to the bottom line in, for a city the size of Phoenix or to whole Maricopa County, you're probably not going to notice it very much, but it definitely is not a net fiscal benefit. And to suggest otherwise is contrary to other research. That's like a doctor coming on here and saying that smoking doesn't cause cancer.
Is there something that's maybe not measurable by, you know, economic data or even other data about a community having a team depart? Like, is there something that maybe is saddening or just sort of not economically depressing, but sort of like a kind of a big bummer for the community if the Diamondbacks, for example, were to relocate?
Absolutely. And it's sort of a myth that when economists talk about the lack of economic impact, that they only look at the financial bottom line data, when in fact there have actually been a large number of studies that try and put a value on this intangible value from, whether it's having a big league city or just, you know, that glee of having a team that you can celebrate a World Series parade. You know, that's a lot of fun. It's great to live in a town. I love having major league sports teams near me where I live in Atlanta. But the question is, what is it worth? And so when economists go in and try and measure what it's worth, people say, sure, I like having a team. And they ask them a series of questions, say, would you be willing to pay $20 a year more in taxes for the team? And it's surprising how little people are willing to pay for these things. And, you know, it's someone's like says, would you like to have a Ferrari? And you said, oh, absolutely. I'd love to have Ferrari. And says, well, your payments are going to be $2,000 a month. You know, well, OK, you know what? I'll settle for the cheap sedan. And so that's when economists do go and look at those sort of intangible benefits, we find they exist. And it's not that they don't exist, but they tend to be quite small. And so we're talking in the tens of millions of dollars, while the expenses for building a stadium are in the hundreds of millions of dollars.
From an economics perspective, is there a difference in a deal like what is being proposed here in Phoenix, where the yes, there would be tax revenue put into this fund, but the team would also kick in a good amount of money to also, you know, go toward renovating the stadium versus a situation where it would be just tax revenue that is being set aside to pay for these things?
I mean, the difference is in terms of magnitude, and that the lesser amount of public money is always preferred. But just because a team is putting some money in doesn't necessarily make the deal better. In fact, sometimes people will say, oh, well, it's a 50-50 split. This seems fair. Well, the government doesn't pay 50% of my mortgage. And so absolutely it's better, but it doesn't make it fair or right.
Would it be different if, for example, it was a strict like a use tax where like the team tacked a $5, for example, surcharge onto ticket sales, or the team was able to add another fee onto concession sales at the park or parking prices, where the public entity still got the same amount of tax revenue that they had been getting, but people specifically using the facility were paying more on top of that, and the team was able to use that money to renovate the stadium?
Right. So my guess is that when the stadium was pitched, that the tax revenue pitched as a benefit. And that was, and so now they want to take that back. But let's go back to a sort of a broader point to your question. And that is, can we use a use tax? So let's say we built a brand new stadium in Phoenix. We implemented a new tax. It was just to pay for the stadium, and it was only paid on tickets, concession sales, and the like. And said, that's going to pay for itself. Well, that would seem appropriate because it is a use tax. It's being paid for exactly by the people who use it. There's no loss in other revenue. But the problem with that is, why would you do that? The team could just build its own stadium and charge higher prices.
All right, we'll have to leave it there. That is J.C. Bradbury, an economics professor at Kennesaw State University, also past president of the North American Association of Sports Economists. J.C., thanks so much for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Mark, for having me.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the impact grief has on the human body.
We know that you can even just call the thought of them to mind. And we see that buffering in people's pain tolerance. Even if they're not in the room, calling them to mind decreases our pain experience.
But first, many of the major changes President Trump has tried to make in his first few weeks in office have already been halted by the courts, from doing away with birthright citizenship to freezing federal grants and funds. Now the question is, will the administration comply? And when will the Supreme Court step in? Just yesterday, a federal judge said the administration had failed to comply with his order lifting the federal funding freeze and ordered the government to immediately restore the funding. And many are questioning if the administration will comply if the Supreme Court rules against it on a major issue, as the president continues to test the boundaries of executive power. It's what our next guest says would result in a constitutional crisis, a place many scholars say we are already headed. Dahlia Lithwick is an author and senior editor at Slate, where she hosts the Amicus podcast. She'll be talking about all of this next month at the John P. Frank Memorial Lecture at ASU School of Social Transformation. I spoke with her more about it and what she's watching for most.
This is going to sound self-indulgent, but I'm watching for speed. Mm-hmm. I think the one thing we learned in the first Trump administration is that nothing happens sort of in ordinary plotting legal due course. Everything is just rocketing around so that you feel like you're, you know, in a video game. And I think, you know, I always tell people there are turtles built into the architecture all over the U.S. Supreme Court building, because the idea is literally like law has to be slow and plotting at its best. That's what it is. This is not that. This is like turtles on roller skates with rocket fuel. And so what we're going to see a lot of is what we saw the first time around. Think about, you know, the Muslim ban, think about the effort to put citizenship on the census. Like, those cases just rocket to the court. They don't necessarily get heard in the court below, go up on appeal to intermediate court. You know, it's just fast. And so you're going to just see a lot of, and we're already seeing it, you know, in the early weeks of the administration, you know, something will happen, say, the president will say birthright citizenship is not, in fact, protected in the 14th Amendment, immediately enjoined in a court below, you know, within 2 days, that goes up. So the posture is going to be emergency, emergency, all the way down.
It's also an interesting moment to watch the Supreme Court itself, because it is an institution that is being questioned for lots of reasons, for conflict of interest, for political bias, in a way that it probably has not ever before. Are you watching those two things collide, like Trump coming into office and being ready to test lots of issues like immigration at the highest court level, and this sort of question of public trust in the Supreme Court, which will be deciding on a lot of these issues?
It's such an interesting question. And, you know, you're exactly right. The court's public approval ratings at this moment are lower than they've ever been since Gallup started polling, right? And that's because of some of the things. The Dobbs decision overturning Roe was hugely unpopular. The court has, you know, done away with precedent in case after case. And then in addition to that, we've seen, you know, these questions of, you know, trips from benefactors that are not disclosed, and, you know, the justices' wives getting involved in really kind of polemical political issues that then come before the court. So you're exactly right. We have not, certainly, I think, in our lifetimes, seen a moment in which public confidence and trust in the court across the boards, by the way, I mean, it's not, you know, necessarily a conservative liberal thing.
Right.
There's just a sense that the court is an entirely political branch. And the other part of the answer to your question, which is really complicated, is that, of course, it's because the court issued not one, not two, but three rulings at the end of last term that all inflected on this question of January 6th and the insurrection and Donald Trump and his immunity, right? Mm-hmm. In some sense, the court handed part of the presidency to the president. And they did that doing this very, very broad theory of executive power, right? For the first time in history, they broadened the idea of presidential immunity. And so in some sense, a lot of what you're seeing Donald Trump doing in his first weeks as president is saying, dude, I'm immune. Let's go. You know, and so the court almost gifted Trump, not just, you know, the fact that there weren't trials before the election, which is, I think, what Jack Smith was hoping, but gifted him this notion that the presidency is sort of above the other branches. And so in some sense, you know, the court has constructed a part of what Donald Trump is now testing over and over and over again in the court, which is, can the president simply freeze funding that's been appropriated by Congress? Can the president rewrite the 14th Amendment with a stroke of a pen? And so it's a really interesting symbiotic moment where the court has given huge power to the president, and the president is asking the court for even more. And as to the question of how the public is going to respond to that, I think we're going to have to wait and see. Yeah. I think that we're going to have to really watch this term. A lot of cases are going to play out, and we're going to have to see if the public thinks that the court and the president are kind of doing an I scratch your back, you scratch mine thing.
There's lots of talk right now, Dahlia, about whether or not Trump will openly defy the Supreme Court if they do not rule his way on any of these major issues he really cares about. Do you see that happening, or where do you see, I guess, the courts trying to step in and maybe limit that power that they have given him?
It's a great question. In some sense, that is the textbook definition of what is a constitutional crisis, right? Yeah. A constitutional crisis is when one branch of government says stop and another branch says make me. And we've seen that historically. And so whatever is happening now, it's not a constitutional crisis. But if the court, as you say, puts a limit on Donald Trump and says, like, no, you can't do impoundment of funds, or no, you can't rewrite what birthright citizenship means, and he goes ahead and tries to do it, then you are in like quintessential constitutional crisis land. And the interesting thing to note is that Donald Trump did a lot of this in his first administration, you know, took huge swings. You may remember, you know, he tried to freeze funds. He wanted to, you know, build the wall with Mexico and appropriate money that wasn't there. You know, he did a lot of putting citizenship on the census. And time again, and I think we forget this, the Roberts Court said no. Even the conservative Roberts Court bopped him on the nose. And in fact, Donald Trump is one of the losingest presidents in American history. As measured against other presidents, generally, the courts tend to say, you know what, go ahead and do it. So he actually has a pretty dismal track record at the Supreme Court, at least from the last go round. And I think the harder question is, he's got different lawyers this time. He's got a different attorney general this time. He's got a lot fewer breaking systems than he had the last time. And then the question really is, if they're egging him on, if his legal advisors are saying, swing for the fences, Mr. President, and if the court says no, we'll do it anyway, that we haven't experienced before. And that's when, even if the court says no, and he goes ahead and does it, that's when we're really in peak constitutional crisis territory.
I mean, I guess this is a crystal ball kind of question, but what happens then?
Well, I mean, then, like, literally you get, you know, the sending out troops to Little Rock moments. I mean, those are the scariest moments in American history, is when you have this kind of intra-branch meltdown, and the branches seeking to check each other can't do that. And, you know, the sort of grim answer is that that's when the military gets called in. I think the less grim answer is that, you know, we've seen Congress pretty much willing to let him do what he wants to do in the last few weeks. And I think that might be a moment in which, you know, if the court says no and the president goes ahead and does it anyway, I think you're going to see states and the Congress start to resist. And again, that is textbook constitutional crisis. That's never a situation in which a healthy democracy wants to find itself. But I think there is a distinct possibility with this maximalist view he has of his own powers that that's where we're headed.
All right. We will leave it on that optimistic note. Dahlia Lithwick, author and senior editor at Slate, host of their Amicus podcast, joining us to talk about this. Dahlia, thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate you taking the time.
Pleasure to be with you, Lauren.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Lauren Gilger. The internet is full of advice right now that has our next guest worried. It goes like this. Protect your peace. When a relationship gets too complicated, cut it out of your life. If a friend cancels plans, you freeze them out. If a family relationship gets too fraught, you stop going to family dinners.
It's usually like a front-facing camera video. They're usually in their car and they seem very upset. And they're talking about, you know, I don't want any more drama in my life. I am protecting my peace this year. So therefore, I am cutting out this person that is bringing all of these negative feelings into my life.
That's Vox reporter Allie Volpe. In a recent piece, she argues always protecting your peace is killing your friendships. At the same time, we are living through an epidemic of loneliness, and we need relationships, ones that are often only strengthened by conflict. I spoke with her more about it.
It's normal and almost okay and celebrated to cut people out of your life for any minor infraction, and therefore that will make your life better.
Mm-hmm. And it goes even further. Like, you see the divorce him thing is going around all over the place now for kind of, you know, minor infringements on marriage, right? But there's also some arguing we should, like, decenter friendship. That's a phrase that's out there. And you cite research that shows that people are cutting out family members, parents, things like that.
Yeah, a YouGov poll found that more than 1 in 4 Americans were estranged from an immediate family member. That is quite a lot of people. And so this impulse, I think, to get rid of that problem is really doing us a disservice as far as the potential upsides that could come from addressing a problem with someone we care about.
Right. So let's get into that argument that you're making here, that this is kind of killing people's friendships. You talked to a lot of experts about the potential harm of this, about what might be behind it. What did they have to say?
Yeah. First of all, that this is a pretty new phenomenon, because again, we are social beings. We need other people to survive. And this is very evident in, you know, our ancestral times. We lived in small groups and we needed to work together to get food, to protect ourselves, to build shelter. And so if you estranged yourself from even one person in this small clan, that could have profound effects on your survival, especially if that person was very well liked and they might convince other people to then turn their backs on you. Then that makes it way harder to try to, you know, get food, protect yourself. But now we live in a world where that's not so much the case. We have all of these modern comforts. But as our society has become more individualistic, our thinking has sort of morphed to think that, you know, only I am responsible for my own needs and my own happiness, away from this idea of collectivism. So if you are of the mindset that, like, you know, I am right all of the time, all I need is myself, I don't trust other people, other people are just trying to get things from me, whether it's, you know, time, attention, you start to see these relationships as not inherently functional. And so instead of working to fix them, you know, you might be more inclined to cut them off when we live in a society that hasn't really reinforced the idea that we need other people around us as much.
Yeah, it is sort of this idea of individualism that you get out here. You write this quote, you say, people are not problems to be rooted out and then discarded. Like, do you think that this is partially just like a misunderstanding of what the point of friendship is? Like, it's not all about me.
Yeah. I do think that we've sort of just become very myopic in our view of our relationships. And people might be thinking, like, you know, well, what can this person bring to me? And of course, like, relationships are two-sided. You need to think about, like, what you are bringing to that other person. Why should someone want to constantly support you or show up for you if you're not reciprocating that in some way? I think a lot of factors are at play here, but it really comes down to, what are we offering other people, and why don't we think it's worth showing up for other people anymore? Because, like, that's the beauty of being a friend to somebody, is showing them how much you care and going that extra mile for them, not cutting them out at the first sign of conflict.
You also argue that there's no such thing, like, as a tension-free relationship. Like, is this just avoidance of confrontation, of uncomfortable conversations? Like, you know, we don't often talk on the phone anymore. Like, everything's via the internet or text message. Like, that must be contributing to this as well.
Yeah. Like, I think this all just speaks to the kind of world that we're in right now, which is kind of disconnecting. You know, we're spending a lot more time alone than ever. We are, you know, turning to our forms of media instead of connecting with others. We're more distrustful of others. We have systems set up so you can avoid people, like delivery services or self-checkout, or we always have our AirPods in when we are around other people. So we have this culture that is really disconnecting. And, you know, to have these conversations, it's hard, it's energy intensive. And so I think people, they want to protect themselves. And I think that's well-meaning, to sort of avoid the thing that's difficult or going to be energy intensive and potentially vulnerable, to sort of, like, hear about the ways that somebody is mad at you or upset with you. We're constantly being reinforced to do the easier thing. And so it completely makes sense to me why this might be the impulse.
Yeah. And it's kind of understandable in some ways, right? Like the world is a lot today. Like, it feels like we're kind of bombarded with problems and issues and too many things to care about and worry about all the time. Do you think it's just part of the digital culture, the 24-hour news cycle that we live in as well?
Yeah, one expert pointed out to me that you know, when so much feels outside of our control, one way of asserting control over our lives is, you know, to deal with the people around us. Like, that is one concrete way that we can have control. So, you know, considering all of the crazy and upsetting things that are happening in our government, in our world right now, people might have the only form of control in their lives over who's in it and who's not.
Yeah.
So it totally makes sense for people to be like, yep, things are feeling really bad. Why would I invite any more badness into my life?
Yeah.
Let's get rid of the source of it.
Yeah. Is there a way, Allie, to protect your peace, right? Without doing this, without cutting people off, without pushing people away, while maintaining the relationships that we kind of need as human beings?
Yeah. So one psychologist told me that having these conversations takes effort and it takes practice. So we shouldn't try to shut down in these moments. Again, like, we shouldn't try to push people away and avoid them in general. And we also should try to avoid the impulse of throwing a label on these people as narcissists or toxic. Instead, we should use more words to describe how we're feeling. Like, I was hurt by this comment, or I felt really rejected when you canceled plans. Mm-hmm. Like, using those I statements is always like therapist tip number one.
Yeah.
Sometimes you might need to take the lead in this conversation too. Like, a lot of people don't have these skills. So it's not bad if the person on the other end is maybe not reacting in the way that you would like. You need to just have empathy for people and understand and have a little bit of grace for them too, of like, there's only so much you're privy to. Like, you don't know what their intentions are unless you ask them. So I think it's worth having a little bit of grace for people too.
Yeah. Allie Volpe, senior reporter at Vox, joining us to talk more about her piece on protecting your peace. Allie, thank you so much for coming on. This is fascinating stuff.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger.
And I'm Mark Brody. Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor has been studying grief for a long time. Part of her interest in the subject is personal. After her mother died, O'Connor began experiencing bizarre neurological symptoms like tingling sensations on her skin. She was ultimately diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And while she knows her condition wasn't directly caused by grief, she wanted to know if the physiological stress brought on by her grief helped create the conditions for MS to emerge. Turns out, it did. And now, O'Connor, a psychologist and neuroscientist at the University of Arizona, has expanded her research into a book called The Grieving Body: How the Stress of Loss Can Be an Opportunity for Healing. O'Connor recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman.
You know, we think of our body ending at the edge of our skin, right? But what science is discovering is that, of course, when we fall in love with someone, if you fall in love with your baby or the person you're going to marry or whomever, when we form that relationship, it's our body that is also co-regulated. You know, that person is our external pacemaker for our cardiovascular system. If I, you know, come home from work and my partner hugs me, my heart rate goes down.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just to speak from my own life, like, one of the things that I treasure the most about my relationship with my wife is that I feel like situations which on my own would be incredibly stressful and overwhelming, just the opportunity to speak with her about them, to not be ashamed of what I'm feeling about some situation that's stressing me out, lessens the overall amount of stress that I'm experiencing.
That's
and
right.
If, God forbid, she was not there to do that, it would increase the amount of stress in my life. And we know that increased stress has all of these attendant physical symptoms.
Yes, that's it. Exactly. And it doesn't even have to be completely conscious. They are in our brain, encoded in our brain. They're in our mind, even at a very subconscious level. So we know that you can even just call the thought of them to mind, and we see that buffering in people's pain tolerance. Even if they're not in the room, calling them to mind decreases our pain experience.
You know, this is so silly, but you're making me think about the fact that I keep a picture of her as the lock screen on my phone.
Exactly.
And I do too. Reasons...
Well, not your wife, but my partner.
No, exactly. It's you're making me realize that the little ping of relief that I get when I unlock the phone and see that image is actually connected to this much more significant thing.
Yeah.
Speaking of this idea of regulation, it seems like one of the key physiological catalysts for these symptoms is something that you seem quite fascinated with called the vagus nerve.
Yeah. The vagus nerve, which is a nerve that runs throughout our body. In fact, it comes from the same word as vagabond. And it's like the brake. So if you're in a car and you release the brake, the car also goes forward, but it doesn't require so much energy, right? You don't have to turn the gas on for that to happen. So what's amazing is that the vagus nerve is helping our heart rate to decelerate, to go down, when we need to rest and digest. And it takes much less energy. It's much easier on the body to use that vagal brake than to have to put the gas on and get the adrenaline going and everything. So the point is really that we can do things to improve that vagal control over our heart. Simple things, even like very deep breathing, improves our vagal control of the heart. So it's one of those avenues into helping our grieving body to rest and be soothed.
Yes. And if I'm not mistaken, the idea is that there are loved ones in our lives that help us do that kind of vagal regulation unconsciously.
That's right. That when we are a part of this, you know, when we're two orbiting bodies around each other, the cues from that person increases our vagal control of the heart, right? So that hug I was talking about. And then when that person is gone and we don't have those day-to-day cues, you know, we can support that vagus nerve by doing things like deep breathing or exercise. We know for sure that regular exercise helps improve that vagal control of the heart, like going for a run regularly, doing yoga regularly. It's a way of supporting that grieving body.
Part of what we've been talking about in terms of this relationship to loved ones who help us self-regulate is this idea of attachment theory. Mm-hmm. And you have a hypothesis that crying, which is obviously something that we associate with grief, is a very important part of attachment-related behavior.
I'm so grateful that you recognize it's a hypothesis. There isn't necessarily current evidence for this idea, but we know that in many situations of attachment behavior, think about nursing an infant or intimacy in a couple, that there are a number of hormones that are released during that, and that those hormones help our brain to encode that other being as this is our one and only. Now, what we do know during crying is that a variety of hormones are released, and some of those are similar hormones as we see in other bonding behavior, so oxytocin, for example. And oxytocin has what neuroscientists call a permissive effect on the brain, meaning when the brain is flooded with oxytocin, it permits the learning to happen more deeply or quickly or however you want to think about it. Mm-hmm. So I think crying during bereavement is part of the brain learning this person is not here now. The hypothesis is it helps us to understand the new reality. And so I think supporting our body is helpful, but also trusting it to be able to do this natural grief response.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit about some of the practical things that you have found to be helpful in your own life.
I finally realized that I need a nap every day. I take a 30-minute nap with an alarm. And for a long time, I had all these, you know, inner dialogue about how I was lazy and I wasn't getting enough work done. And eventually I came to realize that it made me a happier person, but it also ultimately even made my afternoon more productive. So I tried it out. We got to try out new coping strategies. I discovered that for me, it makes an enormous difference. And then I had to sort of overcome all the, you know, the cultural messages about whatever that coping strategy is. And now it is just a very authentic part of my life.
Grief as an opportunity to know yourself better.
That's it. Not that we would ever choose this. And yet, given that we've walked through this door, we can and do learn so much.
Well, I've been speaking with Dr. Mary Frances O'Connor, who is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Arizona College of Science. And Mary Frances will be speaking about this book at Changing Hands on February 11th. Mary Frances, thank you so much for this conversation.
I'm so grateful you asking me these questions and bringing this information to the world.
That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.